LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host, Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Colin E. Davis. If life sometimes seems like a movie, are you an actor, a director, or an extra? Increasingly, cutting-edge science is aligning with ancient wisdom to suggest that this reality is indeed a malleable fabric that each of us has the power to manipulate. The mainstream view is, of course, that we are merely passengers on a brief ride through a hostile universe devoid of meaning and purpose. However, the longer we remain in denial of our own power, individually and collectively, the harder it will be to deal with the converging crises now threatening the very existence of our species. The first quarter of the 21st century has simply seeded even more virulent strains of mind virus, accelerating our course on a path to self-destruction. Most people now on Earth are not and never will be able to take the leap of the psyche that real change requires. The good news is that we don't need everyone to do so. Hello and welcome, Colin, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hi, Greg. It's great to be back with you again.
Now, Colin, today we're having a discussion along the lines touching on the topics that you and I have discussed in the past. We just mentioned off air that it's actually a decade. 2016 was our first talk together about the book that you and Melissa Murray, who will be speaking about a great deal during this talk, published together. So that's quite momentous. I always like to mark anniversaries, as it were, with guests, because there's a reason why I come back and speak to the same people again and again.
Right. Now, we've put out Shadow Tech in 2015, and we probably started talking to you in about 2016, right?
Exactly. So now, our previous talks, people can find linked at LegalizeFreedom.com on the interview page for this. Everything will be there in one easily digestible form. Now, in the not too distant past, Melissa Murray, who was your partner in life and in creativity and in the work that we're going to be talking about, consciousness work, in the inner alchemy, whatever term you care to use, you were partners in all of that. And she passed away from this realm, at least. She's no longer with us. And you've created a movie as a tribute to her life and creativity and spirit. That's entitled Melissa Murray, Musical Alchemist of Stage and Psyche. So that's going to kind of frame our discussion today. And that's the lens through which we'll kind of be looking at some of the topics that you and I, the three of us together, sometimes discussed previously, and which is shadow work, the journey of evolution of human consciousness, where we are as a species, and what might help us get through some of the dark times we find ourselves in now, what the necessary steps, the necessary work is, if we are going to survive in our current form, and not only survive but evolve and hopefully thrive. Before we dive into all that, just tell listeners a little bit about yourself and maybe a word about Melissa before we get started proper.
Okay, yeah. Well, Melissa and I both were musicians, professional musicians, and Melissa played many different styles. My main style was heavy metal music, extreme metal even. And so we met through the music scene in the California Bay Area. And both of us were also spiritual seekers, self-healers for much of our life. And so we had some background. I mean, I was 43 when we came together and Melissa was 50. And so we had had some background, you know, in different domains. And I had been studying Jungian psychology and Melissa had been interested in Yogananda and that whole lineage and all kinds of other spirituality. So we had some background. But then when we came together, we had already been acquaintances, and I had worked with her band as an audio engineer. But when we came together, we basically did not know, you know, what was going to happen. But it's just really astounding, really, because a whole kind of metaphysical explosion happened between us. And we just started psychoanalyzing each other, and we started, you know, basically comparing notes as to what we had been doing on ourselves before, and but we both naturally had an interest in trying to understand the shadow side of reality, which is just a bizarre thing for two people to have an ongoing interest in. And so we came together as a couple, and then we just found ourselves basically downloading just a huge amount of information and perspectives that would help us to form some maps and some context around how and why humans destroy themselves from the inside out. You know, the Jung's shadow and everything related to that. And then also we moved from there. Well, first it took us a few years and we put out a book, Shadow Tech, and we did some workshops and lectures on that. And then we started to put the work into music and we formed a band called the O1 Experience. And we put all of this alchemy is what it is, into the music. And the whole time we're doing the work on ourselves, we're doing shadow work on ourselves, and we're just constantly engaged in this very creative alchemical process. And then that was just, you know, just took over our lives. And so that's kind of the backstory as to how this all kind of came about.
Yeah, well, there was a phrase, whether it was in the movie, whether it came from you or Melissa or both of you, but it almost sounds like a tagline for kind of my own work. In fact, one of the taglines from a website is the nature of reality and the future of humanity. And the phrase that you guys were using for the nature of reality and the evolution of consciousness. And that's kind of like, if you're looking for a tagline for what this is, and it sounds so impossibly vast, but it's really what all seeking, whether, you know, overtly spiritual or, you know, seeking that people don't even realize that they're doing in during their existence, their lives on earth. That's really what it all boils down to. And
yeah,
it's given a wonderful, mm-hmm. wonderfully moving and a very powerful frame in the film, you know, that the work is being explored and discussed. And then you have about everything wrapped up about, you know, you guys coming together as individuals and finding that common purpose. And then the journey, of course, that led through to, you know, Melissa's passing, which is documented there. So I think it's a very meaningful and, as I say, powerful marriage of these, of the kind of abstract issues of like, oh, what is the fundamental nature of reality? What is consciousness? And actually the human journey, a human story, human birth, life, and death, you know, what the journey is here.
Right. Yeah. And you know, you're kind of bringing in the dual track here, because like I mentioned in the intro there of how a lot of this work was centered around understanding the shadow side of the psyche and the shadow side of reality. But there was also the side which was just understanding the nature of reality itself, like you're saying. And we had that phrase, living in the movie, and recognizing how life manifests like a movie. And if you start to pay attention to it and kind of step back and get out of it or see above the events of your life, you can kind of see how everything is transpiring. And it seems like there's scripting going on. And so we were interested in if you can get, how deep could you get into the structure of the movie of reality? And then could you get involved with the scripting of the movie of reality? And so, you know, that was like the other side of the coin on this. And then to the references you made to the movie there. Yeah. In the film, I had to put together, you know, I tried to shove it all into 100 minutes, and I had to put together a whole lot of material. I had to introduce you to Melissa and her spiritual side and show you all of her musical power and talent, because she's just such an incredible, performance artist. And then I had to show you, you know, our life together and all the kind of downloads we were getting and the whole living in the movie concept. And then you had to hear about her story and her own kind of, backstory and the trauma that was involved in her early life and all of that. You had to hear all that. And then you had to see our life together and then her getting ill and working through it and her passing and then sort of retrospectives and interviews with bandmates and family members. And so all this kind of had to go in, plus my takeaway at the end, you know, it all had to go into this one film. And so I kind of really had to kind of jump a lot, but hopefully, and judging from the reviews I have been getting, that I was successful in doing that and really introducing you to the essence of Melissa and to the process that we were engaged in, so that you could kind of really get a feeling for what is it like when two people engage creatively in psychospiritual alchemy and what can kind of come out of it. And then how would you face really difficult things like death when you have this kind of meta perspective going on? And so I was able to translate that.
Yeah, there's an interesting bit in the movie where you're speaking about your journey together to Mount Shasta and this kind of realization about, you know, the air quotes, you know, the movie. And that's such a powerful concept in psychology, isn't it? In terms of like inner work, realizing that you're not your own thoughts. And become the observer of your own thoughts is one of the first steps to sort yes. of that sort of self-actualization, or that moving beyond that mental churn, you know, which is in society at large is kind of just a macro version of that. So, and another movie metaphor is that of the dream, you know, because we can go to the movies and see something yes. that quote unquote isn't real. Yeah, but somebody has directed and people are acting in this movie and somebody's written a script and somebody's directed it. And when you start to make these parallels, it becomes so, and you start thinking about the psychological dimensions I just mentioned. And then you look at the work from Jung onwards, you know, all the work that's been done then in this area, pointing to what this reality ultimately might actually be, and that we are participants, you know, that we affect what's happening around us. You know, I affect your reality, you affect mine. We're all part of a whole ultimately, so interacting, you know, but we see ourselves as atomized and isolated and without agency, but we absolutely do. And I think certainly in the modern world, since the scientific and industrial revolutions and, you know, the modern scientific age, we've increasingly become to see the universe as mechanistic and without meaning and purpose. And that then down at the micro level, you know, mm-hmm. us as individuals, that how could we possibly have any power? But the agency in this reality that we're all part of has got nothing to do with physical size or access to resources. It isn't about that. So I think that all of those insights about the aforementioned concept of this being the movie absolutely apply. And that is really, for me, it's always been the best metaphor for what it is that we're actually experiencing and living through, and indicates how we can influence the experiences that we have, for better or worse.
Yeah, well, this is, well, first of all, it's an ancient realization, right? You know, that life manifests as a dream or like a play, or you have Plato's allegory of the cave, you know, and now we have simulation theory and all of this. And so these are all kind of metaphors to try to help us to understand this big question that you put there of how much agency or free will do we have actually, and you know how involved can we get, and it's it's because Melissa and I we were very much working on unwinding the scripting in our that seems to be running our lives. It seems that you know, you can use Jungian archetypes or whatever way to explain this. But when you really start to look at it, it starts to look like there is scripting. And then when you start to really get into the scripting and try to find its location in the psyche, in the complexes and the different cycles that human beings continually, behavioral cycles that they run, and, you know, ongoing emotional and thought-based cycles that are running, and you start to really trace this down and go, okay, well, what is the fundamental story or scripting that's manifesting these, my internal state as it is, or my life as it plays out? And you start to wonder, well, wait a minute. Like, for example, in Melissa's life, where she had many years of with her life, it was kind of a dichotomy between incredibly brilliant, ecstatic experiences and massively creative experiences, and then falling down into the underworld. So we would often relate this pattern to the archetype of Persephone. And so once we kind of located the influence of Persephone in her psyche, then the question was, okay, well, how could we rewrite that? What could we do with this? Is this going to be present for the rest of her life? Or how can we kind of, like in the very beginning of the movie, you see we're doing a ritual and she's digging a hole and to put a tooth in the hole, and she says this, you know, this Persephone character, I can put her in my art, but I don't necessarily have to let this character keep running my life. And so that's what we were working on. And then when it turns out that Melissa gets cancer, which is something her father had. Her father died at age 54 of cancer. And then she had already had cervical cancer once before, 25 years prior, and she had beat it. And she had always wondered if it was going to come back. And in fact, there was kind of a script running that was saying, this is there. It's like, knock, knock, knock. Here it is. The cancer demon is right there. And so she was always working on that and trying to unravel that and unbind that from her ego. And so we worked on that process just as deeply as anyone could work on that process. And then in the end, Melissa gets cancer and dies. So you have to ask yourself, well, there's these two people incredibly dedicated to understanding these patterns and to digging them out and to doing all the shadow work and the emotional release and all of this that we did. And then the pattern still plays out. And so you have to ask yourself, how much free will do we have? And, I mean, we wanted to become, quote, co-directors of the movie of life. But then we would like to have, you know, written, you know, changed the script a little bit so that this didn't have to happen. So then you have to come back. Now the experiment has been run, or at least the 12-year experiment that Melissa and I ran together, that experiment was run. And I have to now pull out of that, here are the successes, here are the failures, here's the things that we learned, here's the things that we can do, and here's the things that at least so far we have not been able to do. And so it kind of takes me to kind of explain this is, I'll paraphrase a little saying that Alan Watts used to, that I got from Alan Watts, where he says something like, You thought life was a game that you were supposed to win, but actually it was a play and you were supposed to sing and dance. And what that says to me is that the actual base scripting, the big, you know, plot lines, the big elements, story elements that you incarnate into are going to be with you for life. And so what you can do is you can improvise in that play. You can improvise in the movie. And a great actor, you know, takes on the character and takes on the elements of the character and of the story and improvises and makes the character come alive. That's what you can do here. You may not be able to rewrite the basic stories or scripting that are behind your movie of life, but you can certainly improvise and you can bring, you know, just massive amounts of meaning and life to your life. You can live in the movie of life, truly live within it. But can you really change it? How much can you change? You know, I don't know. We're still trying to figure that out. But this was a big test of that. And it's almost a relief in a way, because it's so natural for the human to say, you know, let me live longer, let me learn how to manipulate nature, let me learn how to master my life, win the game, all these kinds of things. And then if you kind of just find out that, well, maybe, you know, it's not about any of that. It's about really just playing in the movie, playing in the play and improvising in it and deriving meaning and life and ecstasy from what you have here. And you don't really have to change that much. You don't really have to fix the world. You just have to, the amount that you have to fix or modify is just the amount that you need to modify just to manifest your daimon. And, you know, so you are going to have to be cleaning yourself up. You are going to have to be working these things out, but you don't have to play God with your own life.
Well, there's another movie analogy there, isn't there, in the idea of winners and losers? Because what do people want at the end of a movie? They want resolution. They want to know who the villains are, even, and the heroes are, even if they switch places throughout the narrative. But they want resolution. They don't want ambiguity at the end. And perhaps that's what this life is about. So the idea that you can win, on that, you know, those narrow ideas are very Hollywood narrative, aren't they? You know,
yeah.
It's like Star Wars or something. You know, ultimately the Empire loses and the rebellion wins, and you know. But in our way of looking at it, it's all one thing. You know, so the rebellion and the Empire is all part of one unit ultimately. So another movie analogy I thought of in there was, you mentioned the Persephone persona and all of that, and not wanting that to run Melissa's life, you know. And then you have, with actors, don't you have people who come to grief, they come undone because they've become overtaken by their characters. Particularly method actors, we see this. You know, don't you? They just become overtaken by, and they just can't separate themselves any longer for the,
from
the person that they're trying to portray on screen, and in our metaphor, you know, in life.
Yeah, we do that all the time. That's the sort of one of the big tendencies that for example Jung would talk about is not to identify with your persona. And, you know, you have a persona, you have a role, you have many roles, but you are not the role. And you want to have flexibility enough in your persona so that you can wear this hat in this role and you can wear this hat in this role. And then you can take off the hat, you know, when you're at work and you're playing that role, that's fine. And then you come home to your family and you take off that hat and now you play a different role. And you have to be flexible, and you don't want to get too caught up in your role. And let your role, your persona, your mask, your character become you, because the mask is just it's very shallow. It's just a mask. It doesn't have the depth that a human being actually has. It doesn't have the spiritual depth that just goes on and on and on. You can just go into yourself and go into the cosmos that way. And so you don't want to just get fixated on your persona. We call that being superficial or shallow. And so this is a tendency that comes with the ego itself, which is a functional aspect of our consciousness, and the tendency to have so much of your consciousness, your center of gravity, be focused right on the mask, on the persona. And so, with what you know, this whole all this kind of inner work, however you call it, alchemy or path of enlightenment or whatever, this is a big part of this is about identifying deeper and deeper and deeper layers of you that are beyond the persona.
Yeah, and I suppose to persist with the movie thing for another moment. Mm-hmm. I think that's, if we talk about, you know, that realization that we're basically living in one, effectively, is that so many people on the earth don't realize that they, in the morning, they came out of the trailer and they went onto the set, and they're now on the set, but they completely forgotten that there's a green room and a trailer, and that they're going to take off their costume, you know, and that they're going to, you know,
right.
and set that persona down.
Right. The analogy that I used to use, or the way I would describe this living in the movie, was most people are sitting in the theater and they're just viewing the screen, and they just let go of themselves and they just project into the screen and they just let the movie run their consciousness for 90 minutes or whatever it is. And they just, you know, they identify with the characters and they're being emotionally swayed by the story and by the characters and all of that. And that's all happening. So they've fallen into the movie. And it's the alchemist, it's the mystic, it's the shaman, it's the spiritual outsider who basically gets up out of their seat in the dark, and they turn around and they see that the movie is a projection, that there's a beam of light coming from a projector room. And then they get out of their seat and they go up to the projector room and they go investigate the situation.
Well, it's Plato's cave, isn't it?
What's that? It's Plato's cave. It's what it is. And they go investigate the situation. They go, oh, wow. Okay, so the movie is being projected through this projector, and there's this film that's going through here. And up on these racks, there's all these movies, and they're all, you know, separated by genre. And then over here, there's a bookshelf with books about how to make movies and how to film movies and how to be a director and how lighting works. And that's what the alchemist is doing. They want to know how the movie is being made, how it's being projected and how it's being made. And of course, that beam of light is your consciousness, your local version of it, which is just your version. If you go to, you know, Kastrup and these kind of people that talk about consciousness, the whole cosmos as consciousness, you know, we are just one little sliver of that, one flashlight of that greater state of being. And but, you know, we're the ones that go investigate how is this being done and how is this made, and can we get, you know, the real alchemist says, well, I want to be a director, I want to learn how to put all this stuff together, and I want to make my own movie of life. And now, so then we had this thing that she called life art, where you can wake up to the fact that there's a story. And the Jungians do this, you know, by looking for the archetypes that are running your complexes. And you can kind of wake up to that, and you can kind of pull that apart and do all that. Then you can also have this real kind of transcendental temporary experience, like an enlightened state, where you actually kind of get out of your own head and you really can kind of see, oh, wow, you know, you can take a psychedelic and see this. You know, get, oh, wow, this is really a movie. And so then there's kind of that aspect of it too. But we had this thing called life art, and life art is where you it's not so transcendental like that. It's not about, you know, trying to get out of yourself and have a transcendental experience, but it's about actually recognizing that your whole life can be treated like an artistic medium. And that when you go into life, whatever it is you're doing, wherever you're working or whatever your relationship is or whatever's going, your hobbies, whatever's going on in life, you just interface with life as an artist does with their medium. And so you just, you put everything that a deep artist puts into their creation process, you put that kind of consciousness into your life. And so your life becomes a work of art. And so it kind of requires the artist mindset, the artist perspective. And not everybody who, if you're not, I mean, Melissa and I were both already lifelong artists and we both kind of got this. Not everybody really gets all of the perspectives that naturally an artist is seeing through, the lenses that an artist is seeing through. So you kind of have to put on the artist lens and you have to start looking at things through that lens, and you have to kind of learn to be an artist, whether you're an actual physical artist or not. And then you just kind of live your life in this way. And then we kind of had kind of two sides to that. You have more of the secular kind of life artist that everything they do is just very creative and cool and fun and funky and all of that. And then you have the spiritual side of it where everything they do is also creative and cool and funky and original, but there is a deeper spiritual message and meaning and transmission that they're putting into their life art.
Yeah, in those terms, I would go back to something that I mention very often when discussing the idea that we at least help fashion our own reality, and that we have an influence in this, that we're not just passengers, that whether you feel that to be the case or whether you dismiss the very idea, you know, if you're just a fundamentalist materialist, whatever worldview you have, whatever cosmology, and whatever way you view that idea of our role in shaping our experience and the collective experience, You're kind of doing it anyway. So, and what you bring to that, you know, if it is complete denial and negation, that's the filter through which your, you know, your life will contribute to this. So to use the art analogy, that, you know, what is art? What is an artist, for example? If people don't feel that they could be artists or that they could create art, you're doing it anyway. It's just, that's just a label that we're giving it. So some people will understand that or at least intuit that and feel it. And as you, I liked your idea of the secular artist there. And some people in denial, in, you know, of that negation of that, will not even pick up any of the materials. They'll start with a blank canvas and they'll finish with a blank canvas. But that's what they did, you know. And in modern art circles, a blank canvas apparently can be worth quite a lot.
That's great. Your life is a work of art, whether you become aware of it or not. You won't realize it unless you become aware of it. And if you just, you could even just wake up to it and look back at it and see it, because everybody can at least appreciate art. Even if you don't think you can make it, you can appreciate it. And so you could potentially look at your life and see, wow, someone created this thing. That's quite a work of art. And at least you can appreciate it and just see it through that lens. But then it's just a small step to start saying, okay, well, maybe I can start, you know, dabbling with it and see what I can do here. And it would be good for, I think it would be good for it's, this is just a good piece of advice to anyone is to, I mean, everyone's doing something artistic. Everybody's doing something artistic. And it's just do more art, you know, get involved in more art, develop the skills that you might have, you know, you might have started playing piano or whatever, or you might have started whatever as a child or painting or drawing, but, and you have some talent in one of those directions, but you just didn't pursue it. Well, whatever one of those directions you have natural talent in, you should just pick it up and start pursuing it. or find wherever it is now. And definitely, I think this is especially for people on a spiritual path. You know, I think most people on a spiritual path are going to be interfacing with art in some way or another. And so, yeah, just in fact, I mean, people who are really afraid of making art, you can just do finger painting. You can just get paper and get finger paints that kids use and start playing with that, and you'll start coming up with some pretty amazing stuff. So, I mean, yeah, everybody should be definitely exercising their art complex in the psyche and in whatever way they can. And but I do admit that the whole life art perspective is something that kind of is a natural for people who are already on the art path.
Well, in human evolutionary history or development of consciousness, there, of course, from countless millennia, as far as we know, we would have been like an oral culture, you know, before the development of writing, you know, so our stories of who we are, where we have come from, what reality is, what the cosmos means, where we might go in the future was all told in, you know, in stories and handed down. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking here again of Julian Jayne's work on the evolution of consciousness and how mm-hmm. our more collective, all is one feeling of being at one with all the world around us, and that separation that was triggered at probably a necessary phase of our developing individual consciousness, but how that ultimately led through to, I was talking about modern art, I was disparagingly, of course, but, you know, through into the modern era and where we find ourselves now, how the stories that are told, you know, through the movies, that materialistic lens, people still crave those stories, don't they, of like heroes? All the archetypal characters, you know, that Jung wrote about, and I mentioned Star Wars earlier, just stuffed with all those archetypes. You know, the fairy tale, which is basically what Star Wars is stuffed with those, and people, they still resonate with people, and the little girls want to be Princess Leia, and guys want to be Han Solo, and some other guys kind of go, I kind of like Darth Vader, you know, I can see myself doing that. But that becomes more and more watered down, and now we, you know, in the early 21st century, it's hyper extended into this Marvel universe, isn't it? But it just has no meaning whatsoever, and I feel that reflects, you know, kind of inversely reflects the lack of agency or power that the individuals have, that they feel that they have over their own existence, over their own lives, to actually do anything and achieve anything and be anything and mean anything, you know.
Oh yeah, I was talking about this on my last podcast, actually, is horizontal flatland. Mm. And so I was talking about the idea of the Axis Mundi, the center of the world, you know, sacred mount, the world tree, and this whole archetypal motif that's always in all the creation myths and everything. And it's like, or the Christian cross. And it's the intersection of the horizontal and the vertical. So the horizontal is the world of time. It's Chronos time, and it's progress, and it's the world. It's everything material, and that's, you know, and that's what we just get. You know, it's so easy to just get totally caught up in the material world and your material needs, and, you know, my car needs fuel, and take the kids to school, and blah blah blah, and the job promotion and all that, and fix the house and everything else. It's just all material stuff. It's just real world stuff. And then you have the vertical axis, and that's the spiritual domain. That's the transcendent. That's the sacred. That's sacred time. That's Kairos.
That concludes part one of our interview. Part two will be available soon in the subscribers area at legalizefreedom.com.
Legalizefreedom.com.